Today it is my great pleasure to have with me Dr. Michael, also known as Mick Womersley, and I'm sure that I'm mispronouncing your name. Apologies.
That's actually pretty good.
Okay, good. Who is a professor at Unity College and the faculty advisor to the Unity College Search and Rescue Team. Well, thanks so much for coming in.
You're very welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
You were telling me that the reason that your last name is a little unique is because it's actually...
It's English. I'm British. I'm from Yorkshire, and that's a Yorkshire place name, actually. So there's a small town called Womersley in Yorkshire.
So one, I guess, the first obvious question, which I'm going to have to ask, is how did you end up in Maine?
Well, I just was getting done. I was in the last couple of years of my PhD in environmental policy, and I needed a job. My research funding had run out. And so Unity College was looking for people to teach in its general education program, and I landed the job before I'd quite graduated with the PhD. I was ABD, as they say, all but dissertation. And so I found myself at Unity College, and I've stayed there ever since.
Unity College is a really unique school here in Maine. We have a lot of great educational institutions, and Unity is
I like to
thing.
Think it is unique. I like to think of it as a unique institution on a nationwide level and sort of a hidden gem of Maine's colleges.
So tell me what it was about Unity, besides the fact that it offered you a job, but what was it about specifically that school that drew you?
Well, I was very interested in getting a place that allowed me to express all the different aspects of my personality and interests, and search and rescue is something I've done since I was in the Royal Air Force. I've been involved in search and rescue since 1979, and Unity College having a search and rescue team was quite important. But you know, it was also important for me to teach at an environmental college that had a progressive and activist approach, and Unity College meets that definition as well.
For people who aren't familiar with the term search and rescue, what does that actually mean?
Well, search is when you're out there looking for people that are lost, and rescue is after you find them and you get them back to safety. The rescue part is actually the easy part, generally speaking. That's emergency medical technology and also evacuation technology. Search is very difficult, particularly if you have an awful lot of ground to cover, and Maine is big, and we often have an awful lot of ground to cover.
So one would think that one would not necessarily think of a college that's known for an environmental education as also having this search and rescue aspect to it.
It's not necessarily a natural connection, but a big facet of the Unity College degree, one of the most important degree programs at Unity College, is our conservation law enforcement program. And that prepares students for work in the uniformed law enforcement agencies that deal with wildlife protection and essentially rangering around the country. And those students need a background in search and rescue. Our big connection is, of course, to the Maine Warden Service, which is another national treasure. I'm very pleased to have spent, you know, these last 17 years working regularly with the Maine Warden Service, and in fact to have placed quite a few of my students in the Maine Warden Service. You know, since we've had Northwoods Laura, we've actually seen the Warden Service on TV, and so we know what they do firsthand, or at least from the TV. You know, and it's a wonderful job they do, and it's a very important job. They have over 500 search and rescues a year. And for comparison, Unity College might get involved, Unity College search and rescue team might get involved with 4 or 5 of those. So they do the bulk of the work. We get called in when they need extra people to do large-scale searches, and that's our specialty. And we can provide a large number of students that are sufficiently trained and sufficiently fit, and the fit part is perhaps the most important, so that the Warden Service doesn't have to worry about having a bunch of students in the woods. You know, they've got the background, they've got the training, they've got the map reading, the navigation, and they're young and agile, and so they can clamber over rocks and gullies and trees and rivers and streams without necessarily getting hurt quite as easily as I would. And that's an important facet for the Maine Warden Service.
But you also began this when you were young and agile. You joined the Royal Air Force when you were 17.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I didn't start, I had a year of technical training before I joined the Royal Air Force Mountain Rescue Service, but I did spend 5.5 years in Royal Air Force Mountain Rescue, and I'm still heavily involved with the ex-servicemen's group that belongs to Royal Air Force Mountain Rescue. But I've been in this country since 1986 now, and I've actually been on more American search and rescue and mountain rescue teams than I ever was on Royal Air Force Mountain Rescue teams. So I've been doing this for a long time, even in this country.
So what is the draw? How does one become interested in doing search and rescue, aside from doing it with the Air Force? But I would imagine you wouldn't keep doing this if there wasn't something about it that appealed to you.
I think perhaps I have a inflated sense of duty, and it might be a mistake some of the time. You find yourself out there in bad weather and wondering what it is that you're doing and why you signed up for this. But somebody has to do it, and so let's think about this. Your organization promotes travel to Maine, and so people are going to come to the state of Maine, and some of them are going to go in the woods, and some of them are going to get lost necessarily. And so the great state of Maine has the Maine Warden Service, and a big part of their job is to rescue people, search for and rescue people from the woods and waters of the state of Maine. But they simply can't have enough people. It's not cost effective for them to have the several hundred people on standby that it would take to run a very large area search using grid searching technique. Some of the bigger searches that we've been involved in, might have upwards of 200 people from all the different volunteer search and rescue organizations in the state of Maine. We have an umbrella organization, Maine Association for Search and Rescue. I've been part of that now for a long time. So we're very sure to work with Maine Association for Search and Rescue and to do all the things that we need to do to certify our students and to be part of the system, to be a productive, responsible part of the system.
We've had Kate Braestrup on the show a couple of times, and she's a chaplain who works.
I know Kate.
You know Kate. So yeah. She has spoken about and written about as an author some of the circumstances when the rescue isn't a rescue, it's a retrieval, and the difficulties surrounding that. You're bringing college students into...
It can be tough. It can be very tough. We've had more than one occasion where our students have been first on the scene to find someone who passed away. And, on the one hand, you worry about having to protect students, particularly the younger students from the kinds of shocks that and even post-traumatic stress disorder that can occur if you have an awful lot of that. But on the other hand, those students that are going to go do this for a living, it's probably the case that the sooner they get exposed to some of the sadder events, the better. We have to teach them how to deal with that. And a big part of my job is the advisor. I do occasionally go in the field still, but as you can probably guess, that's not a most effective role for me. My most effective role is making sure that the students are ready to go in the field. And part of that is, are they mentally ready? Particularly when we know that we're probably looking for someone who's, if someone's been out there a long time, if the weather's been really bad, a lot of the time, you may not say it out loud, but you kind of know that you may be looking for someone who's already passed away. And that can be very sad, and it's pretty important to make sure the students are prepared. And I have a kind of a pep talk that I make sure and give them and get them ready for that.
How does one become trained in this field? What are the different facets of training required in order to do search and rescue?
Well, the basic skill is, can you hike in the woods and the hills? And so you have to be fit enough to be able to hike. We use a fitness test as a as a basic test to find out if students can manage that. Then we need to be able to navigate using map and compass across the woods and fields, and to be able to, in particular, since the Unity College Search and Rescue Team is most frequently doing the kind of search that we call a grid search or a line search, that requires you to be able to take a bearing across a piece of wooded terrain and to hold to that bearing particularly on the left and the right sides of the line, so that you sweep across and then you pivot and sweep back in the other direction, and you don't want to have a whole lot of overlap between those two. So you need to be able to walk on a bearing pretty well. You need to be able to use a GPS. We need them to have at least the basic first aid and CPR. We like it when students go out and get more advanced first aid and CPR skills. We like it when they get EMT or paramedic. And quite a few of our students are also members of our local volunteer fire department, so they often get those qualifications as a result of their other volunteer work with the volunteer fire department. We also run something called Wilderness First Responder, which is a proprietary first aid course every year or so at the college, and students will participate in that. And this hasn't changed since I first got involved in this in 1979. The first qualification is, are your legs and your back strong enough that you can do this without getting hurt? Unfortunately, that's no longer true for me.
Well, we all have a role, right? So your role is also as important as when you were starting to do this as a younger person.
I had some very good team leaders when I was young, and I still remember them, and some of them are still very good friends of mine. And they were mentors to me, and I try to pass that on to the students that I'm responsible for.
At the same time, we've been talking about all of the stuff that you do with search and rescue, but you also have a very rich and quite interesting academic background.
Well, that's nice of you to bring that up. I'm a climate policy scientist. I work in climate policy and in economics, and I'm responsible for a degree program at Unity College that trains students to become involved in the renewable energy business, which is one response to climate change.
So have you found there to be any crossover between the work that you do in one area and the other?
Well, there is, and this is the way, and you'll only get this from someone who teaches general education at a college, right? But what is your understanding of the good society? What kind of a society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a society where volunteering is recognized and important, where there are organizations that will come look for you if you get lost in the woods, where you wouldn't necessarily get billed for an expensive rescue, as might be the case in some of the countries and even some of the states in the Union? And you can take that same idea, the idea that there is some greater understanding of a good society that we can talk about, and you can apply that easily to climate policy. I have a young daughter. She's 2.5 this month, and I want to be sure that she grows up in on a planet with a stable climate that isn't going to descend into the kind of chaos that, when I'm long dead, she will have a good deal of trouble dealing with. And that's the connection that I make.
You wrote your dissertation on American religiosity and climate science acceptance.
There was a moment in American politics about 16, 17 years ago when I just got done with the dissertation where it seemed like religious groups might get involved in climate change politics, and they did to some extent. There is an organization called the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. It still exists today. And they were trying to get all of the churches, particularly the mainstream churches, the Catholic churches, Anglican, Presbyterian, and so on, involved in lobbying for good climate policy. Now, the organization still exists. I'm afraid I made the mistake of thinking in my PhD dissertation that it would be more powerful than it was.
Do you think it's still possible that that could happen?
Well, I think one has to think about, again, the kind of society you want to live in. And I think, religious organizations are very much under this responsibility as much as any of the rest of us, particularly academics, right? Religious organizations share with academics the responsibility for promoting a vision of the good society. Science tells us that the climate is going to get a lot more difficult for people to live with over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and that by the end of the century, Maine will have a climate that is more like Virginia's than the climate that we have right now. I don't know about you, but I don't think that Mainers would feel good about living in a state that had the climate of Virginia. They signed up to live in Maine, not Virginia. If we don't do better at mitigation and adaptation, we'll face that possibility. And that's what the science tells us. And so I think it's incumbent upon those organizations in society whose job it is to think about how a good society is constructed. And I would include religious leaders, academics, politicians, radio show hosts, you know, anyone who is part of the fabric of society, that's part of the way that society ponders such questions. I think it's incumbent upon us all to think about it. And to my mind, the connection between search and rescue and planetary rescue, if you will, is pretty clear and straightforward. One of the reasons I left the British military and I cut my career short was because it was pretty clear at the time that we were not heading into a good place as far as the global environment. In the 1980s, we were just starting to become aware of global environmental problems, and I felt like I needed to get involved in those, and I have. But I've still kept my interest in search and rescue.
Was there anything about your early years that caused you to understand this need that you have to be a good member of society? Whether it's doing climate change education or whether it's doing search and rescue work?
Well, I was lucky that the Royal Air Force allowed me to get involved in search and rescue. What I was really trained for was to fight World War III. And so I was a jet engine technician, and there was a point in time when I was in charge of a flight of F-4 Phantom jets based on an air base facing the North Sea, and our jets were on QRF, quick reaction force, from time to time, and we were trying to intercept Russian bombers that would come across the North Sea and try to penetrate our airspace. And, you know, it's sort of hard to do that without beginning to think about how society is constructed. There are some people that can do it, and you and I both know that there are some people that don't question, you know, the situations they find themselves in and how society works. But by the time you've sat on QRF enough times and you've watched your fighters scramble off over the North Sea, I think you do start to think about things. And that's what happened to me. I had to start thinking about things. Shortly after I left the Air Force, my roommate at the time, his name is David Wally. He's a personality in the British mountain rescue scene, but he was the senior team leader in charge of the Lockerbie crash. That was 3 years after I left. I wasn't involved in that. But David and I have stayed in touch all this time. And, you know, when you think about what happened at Lockerbie, that was over Christmas in 1988. And, you know, all the different RAF mountain rescue teams were scattered all over the country for training periods. And all of a sudden, bodies started falling out of the sky over southern Scotland. And so then they all had to converge. They had to get in their vehicles and converge on this scene, and what a scene it was, with houses on fire and, you know, jet engines lying in the street. And I wasn't there, but, you know, a lot of my friends were. And I think it drove home for me, and it, you know, to witness it from afar, and it certainly drove home for them how important it is to think about how society is constructed and the way that you have to make some decisions about what kind of society it is you want to live in. And for me, one of the answers is, well, I was trained to do search and rescue, and so it's an easier contribution for me to continue to do search and rescue when I have all this training and all this background than it would be to take on some other area of volunteering, and I can make, I think, a stronger contribution. But I need to mention the folks, you've asked a lot of very personal questions, and I'm flattered, But I need to mention that this is a team game, and so we're working here in the state of Maine with the Maine Warden Service. You know, the guy that I work with most frequently on this is Maine Warden Lieutenant Kevin Adams. He's generally in charge of search and rescue planning for the Maine Warden Service. And then we have, you know, the Maine Association for Search and Rescue and all of their member teams, former warden technician Deb Palman, who's a expert search dog team person, is in charge of Maine Association for Search and Rescue. And there are literally hundreds of volunteers all around the state, of which my small team is only 20 to 30, depending on how many students I have involved at any given time. I can wax down to 10, and I can wane down to 10, and I can wax up to 40, depending on the time of the year. But we make a good contribution. We show up on time with students that are fit enough and strong enough and trained enough to do the work that the Maine Warden Service needs us to do. And, you know, I'm proud of that.
Is there some aspect of the work you're doing, maybe an attempt to do something really very practical and very concrete in the face of this very almost amorphous and difficult conversation about climate change, where, you know, we can't just recycle and compost and then we're going to bring the temperatures down?
I think it is a very difficult problem, and so as a result of that, a large number of people in the United States and around the world just kind of give up on it. It's what we sometimes call in academia a wicked problem, which is a good use of that old New England term, wicked. But it really is complex and difficult, and a lot of people give up on trying to understand it without even trying. Part of the problem, I think, is that whilst there are simple, straightforward things that we can do, they're not necessarily easy. It's hard to use less fossil fuels, particularly if you have, for instance, a home that is heated with oil, if you have a family that you need to look after in that home, if you can't afford to buy an electric car, or in many cases in Maine, electric cars are impractical part of the year. It's difficult to know what to do. And, you know, scientists, we love complexity. I mean, we deal in complexity, and there's nothing I like more than being able to understand complex systems. And, you know, I'm naturally predisposed, in the same way that I used to be predisposed to figure out the innards of a jet engine, I'm naturally predisposed to figure out how the climate system works and how climate policy works. And we like that kind of complexity. But it doesn't help us when we have to explain things to ordinary people. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, for nearly a generation now, climate scientists have been trying to avoid something that we sometimes call runaway climate change. And this is the situation where our climate begins to spiral out of control. It's no longer easy to understand where it's going to end up. And internationally, we've set a goal of 2 degrees Celsius global warming, and we're trying to limit anthropogenic climate change to 2 degrees Celsius global warming. And we've told ourselves, for pretty good scientific reasons, that if we can do that, then we're going to avoid this very dangerously destabilizing runaway climate change. I don't think we've done a good job of communicating the potential horror of dangerously destabilizing climate change. Most people imagine, I think most people that are thinking about climate change in the United States imagine things are just going to get a bit warmer. And they probably will. More than likely, that's what happens. Things just get a bit warmer. Maine finishes up by 2050 with a climate more like that of southern New York State, by the end of the century with a climate more like that of Virginia, if we don't do anything, if we don't mitigate. But what's really scary about that is if you allow that to go forward, if you don't mitigate, if you don't reduce fossil fuel emissions, then you stand this increasing chance of encountering this runaway situation, this dangerously destabilizing climate change. And, you know, scientists are naturally reticent and conservative, and we don't like to do what politicians do, which is to scare people with scary stories that make them vote for, you know, politicians that are, you know, that have simplistic views of things. Scientists have avoided talking about dangerously destabilizing climate change, but everything we're doing internationally is based on the attempt to avoid runaway dangerously destabilizing climate change. And it may only be a very small chance. Maybe it's, you know, maybe what happens is the climate warms, and then it warms a bit more, and then it warms a bit more, and it doesn't really get to too terrible, you know, a situation, and it sort of levels off, and there's a good chance that that might happen. But there's also a good chance, and we know this from some of the work that some of my colleagues have done, even with some of my colleagues at Unity College, that there are built-in feedback loops in the climate system that allow it to spiral out of control. I have a colleague, Kevin Spiegel, who goes around the country looking for times in geological history where we've had rapid climate change. And he uses lake sediments to, you know, and palynography, pollen analysis of lake sediments on the basis of pollen and other variables to try to figure out when those things have happened. And they have happened. There have been times when the planet's climate has warmed dramatically, as much as 10 degrees Celsius over a very, very short period of time, a few decades. And, you know, human society is not organized to deal with that kind of change. It would be very, very difficult, and it would lead to a lot of civil and social unrest, if not war. And we need to do what we can to avoid that. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I don't think climate scientists, I think climate scientists have typically avoided talking about the potential for a dangerously destabilizing climate change whenever we've had the chance to talk to the media. You giving me an opportunity today to talk to the media. We've tended to stick to, you know, the straightforward, well, you know, Maine is going to finish up with a climate more like that of Virginia if in 100 years' time if we don't do anything to reduce fossil fuel emissions. And you know, there are probably some people out there that are thinking, you know, Virginia's got a nice climate. I'm not worried about that. And it's entirely possible to think, you know, to be a reasonable human being, and perhaps if you're not that interested in things like forests and habitat and moose and lynx, you know, perhaps if you don't understand about those things, you may not think it's such a bad thing. Right? You might think, well, it's going to be warmer. That's nice. I can grow tomatoes out of doors without having to worry about it. But it's that small possibility that in addition to that kind of warming, we risk dangerously destabilizing or runaway climate change. I think that's the thing that we have to avoid. And the way to avoid it is to reduce fossil fuel emissions. It's unfortunate that there are an enormous number of wealthy people around the world who have ownership rights in fossil fuel. And they're just naturally going to do whatever they can, despite the fact that they have children and grandchildren. Right? That they believe that either the climate science is not correct, or that perhaps they'll be rich enough that these horrors won't fall on their children and grandchildren. Is that what they're thinking? I don't really know. I mean, I don't get to talk to that many rich people. But it beggars belief that anybody who was a intelligent person who wasn't afraid of ideas, who had studied climate science, who had children and grandchildren, it beggars belief to me that they would be unwilling to adopt sensible mitigation technology, especially when, and this is what I find is very important. I've been involved in, I'm primarily an economist, a policy PhD is primarily an economist. And I can demonstrate quite easily that renewable energy is now as cheap as a lot of fossil fuel and getting cheaper all the time. And so it's not even that this would really cost us anymore. Luckily, you know, there are plenty of commercial interests that are on the side of climate change, the insurance companies, the big tech companies, you know, who don't have ownership in fossil fuel. And so I think this will sort itself out in the long run. The question is, will it sort itself out in time? And that's what worries me. That was a lot. You got quite a lot. You got a few large paragraphs there with just one question, didn't you?
Well, I think it's exactly as you've said. I think if you're willing to come in here and talk to us about what's actually going on from your standpoint as a scientist and as an economist, then it's worth listening to.
Well, thank you for that. I thought I was coming here to talk about search and rescue, so it's great that I got a chance to talk about the rest of my work, too.
Searching and rescuing the planet, I think, is also at least rescuing. I think we've already found it, from what I can tell.
Yeah, we know where it is.
We know where it is.
Third rock from the sun.
There you go. I've been speaking with Dr. Mick Womersley, who is a professor at Unity College and the faculty advisor to the Unity College Search and Rescue Team. You've given me a lot of things to think about, and I really appreciate your coming in today.
You're very welcome. I'm glad I could be here.